Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today's show, we're welcoming back Bob Weiss, our certified ethical hacker, who joins us every few months to give us an overview of what's going on in the world of cyber espionage. Well, today we're going to be talking about the latest in that world. He's also going to explain what the dark web is. And we're also going to talk about the numbers. There's billions lost to U.S. businesses each year. And the United States government has put out some numbers saying anywhere from $100 billion, if you just look at, you know, the straight losses, versus up to $994 billion, if you look at all the ramifications and the losses that go, you know, beyond just the immediate losses. So it's pretty damaging to industry. And then we're going to look at some of the fun things, like how the movies relate to reality, you know, all the different hacking scenes that you see. Is it possible to shut down the stoplights at the intersection and take control of them? And then we're going to talk about the motives behind Iran, Russia, and China, and also North Korea, and some of the things that are going on there. It should be a very interesting show today. So now I'm going to welcome Bob Weiss to the program. Hi, Bob. Welcome back to the program.
Hi. Thanks, Sarah. I'm happy to be back.
Yeah, I love it when you come. It's always so fun. So I'm going to dive right into some of these crazy topics here. What is the dark web, or also called the deep web?
Yeah, and you know, there are some people who would make a little distinction in that the deep web is actually part of the commercial web that's unavailable unless you are a paid subscriber. So there's stuff on the internet that Google can't search, because it's locked up in big databases like LexisNexis and, you know, things like that.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but the dark web is the part of the internet where cyber criminals kind of like exchange stuff. They buy and sell products and services and you know, malware exploits. And, you know, so for instance, if I wanted to be a spammer, I could go out in the dark web and kind of search around and find people who will hook me up with the hardware and the software and the lists and everything that I need in order to become, you know, a spammer. Or similarly, I can go on the dark web and buy a list of usernames and passwords. You know, there are people working, you know, cyber criminals who are working on, say, breaking into web servers and extracting the encrypted database of usernames and passwords, you know, and there might be 10 or 20 or 40 or 100,000 names and passwords that they get, or, you know, identity information like when they broke into that healthcare website and what have you. But with passwords, passwords come out in the database and they're encrypted, and there are guys who basically their full-time work or their specialty or their niche in their business, if you want to look at it like a business, which I guess we should, is that they put powerful high-speed equipment to work at solving for the encrypted password.
So, because they're trying to get into important...
Yeah.
They're trying to make money, so they're trying
And then I sell these user IDs and passwords. So the user ID is typically somebody's email account. You know, it's bobwiseguy@gmail.com or whatever, okay? And so the first place I go is I go to the email account that's also the username, and I try that password and see if I can log in there. If I can log in there, then I can go and read your email for a while, get to know you a little better. You know, just on the sly, quietly in the background, do my research on you. And then at that point, I can start either sending you an email to get you to click on a link that'll get you a Trojan horse, and then I can log into your computer and track what you're doing online and steal your credentials for banking and all, you know, I mean, it's crazy. But anyway, so there's password guys out there. That's all they do. So
is it to the point where anybody who really wants to get at you probably could get to you?
Yeah, we really have to be working under the assumption that our information is already blown. I tell people in the talks that I do, you know, about public seminars and the classes that I teach, that if your password is under eight characters or less, it's undoubtedly been solved and for sale. Yeah, and sure. You know, so there is some value in changing your password periodically. So at least they got to go through the effort of, you know,
just make it a little harder for them. A little harder for them to steal from you.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, the solution that's still fairly viable yet is going longer on passwords, you know, 12, 14, 16 character passwords take a long time to solve for. And the reason for this is that you can't crack an encrypted password in the sense of guessing the encryption keys. And what you have to do is you have to create an encrypted result for every possible 8-character combination, every letter, number, character. So in 8 characters, that ends up being, I think, 575 trillion combinations. Well, there's high-speed equipment out there that these guys are using that'll solve that in under a week for every possible combination. And then when they get an encrypted result that matches the encrypted result in the list that they stole from a web server, they have the solution.
Oh, I see.
Okay, so it's more like matching. You know, it's like we create a five, you know, 500 trillion, you know, 500 trillion password list, and then we match the passwords we have using software, of course, high-speed data matching, with the list that we stole. And when we get a match, we know what the password is. And then those lists are sold.
So is the dark web essentially things affiliated with cybercrime, or is it also things that are a crime in general that they're using the dark web for? And what does it mean to be on the dark web? It's not searchable by Google. And how are they doing that?
Yeah, well, the thing is that they, excuse me, the dark web there's forums, like discussion forums and what have you. In order to be in the forum, you have to be a member. And so you join, and it, you know, basically anything that's hiding behind a user ID and password is invisible to Google. There's a new project coming out of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, the fine people who in 1969 gave us the internet, started that project and became the internet. Well, they're working on creating a search engine for the dark web called Memex. And it's being made available. I mean, it's still under development. It's being made available, of course, to
law enforcement
departments of every stripe and caliber. But it's an open source project that is open to the public. And so for people who are really curious about the dark web, well, you can go out and get the Memex stuff from DARPA, install it on your computer, and then go hunting. The thing you have to realize about lurking on the dark web is that these are bad people. And if they figure out that you're some sort of noob that's just rummaging around, they are going to spank you. And they're going to, you know.
It's like walking into downtown New York in the wrong area.
Yeah, well,
you might have an idea that I don't belong there.
Yeah, it's like being on Hennepin Avenue at bar close. You know, bad stuff happens. You know, if you're like a, you know, some doofus from the farm, you're just going to get whacked, and it's not going to be pleasant. But you may end up with a fine story. If I were, you know, to be, if I was planning on researching the dark web, which actually I am, I haven't, but it's on my list of, it's on the short end of my bucket list, I guess we would say professionally. You know, I would have a computer that would be a sacrificial lamb. I would not be using my day-to-day computer. I'd have a special computer set up that if it got toasted, I would be fine. You know,
you can just throw it. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. You have to know.
Reinstall
another, you know, reinstall Linux one more time. And that's the other thing, you know, you run on Linux. Everybody out there is on Linux anyway, on the dark web for the most part. And, you know, you can sign into some of the forums and, you know, mess around out there. A lot of the forums are Russian language, so it helps if you're fluent in Russian.
Well, how much of the cybercrime actually originates from Russia?
Actually, quite a bit. What was an early, they were early adopters of the internet for criminal purposes, and you know, part of that was, you know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the democratization, if we will, of the Russian republics, a lot of highly trained, you know, computer scientists and software engineers and what have you that were had been working for the government now weren't working for anybody, and
they needed to eat.
And they needed to eat, and there were people who hired them and paid them actually quite well to set up, you know, spamming operations. And, you know, the Brian Krebs wrote the great book, Spam Nation. I still think just reads like a spy novel, where he talks about how the Russian cybercrime set up the whole Canadian pharmacy, and I'm air quoting Canadian, you know, the Canadian pharmacy thing, and we're selling drugs, you know, prescription drugs. Over the internet without a prescription, without needing necessarily to have a doctor. And these would be shipped into the country from drug manufacturing companies in India and China more often than not. Nothing actually came from Canada, but, you know, they were, you know, real drugs that really worked for the most part. Quality control was, you know, not guaranteed. And every now and again, somebody get a batch that, you know, wasn't really good.
Wasn't good stuff.
Well, you know, or that sometimes contaminated with radioactive materials or with things like arsenic and, you know, things that are not good for you. And, but for the most part, it was, you know, they were selling legitimate products at prices that were discounted way below at least what we pay for drugs in the United States. And provided great customer service, no questions asked, refunds. If you didn't like the batch you got, it was like, yeah, we'll send your money back. And, you know,
they had a legitimate business going, except the fact that they lied about where it was coming from.
Well, that and the fact
and the
that,
spamming.
You know, that all the, at least Western countries have rules about how drugs get dispensed, and you have to have a prescription, and you have to have a doctor, and you need to, you know, have actually seen it. And some of these guys were selling, you know, like anabolic steroids and other performance enhancing drugs. And some of them were selling, you know,
Sudafed, maybe
Oxycontin and the other, yeah, you know, narcotic type, you know, the opioid type drugs without a prescription. And, you know, so that creates problems. But in some cases that were described in the book, they're just selling, you know, expensive medications that worked on, you know, tough diseases that people had and just needed to get drugs that weren't setting them back, you know, $300 a dose like we charge here in the United States. Yeah.
So for some people, it really helped. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, your blog talks about a lot of different things, but you talk about the energy industry and
yep.
how the infrastructure, well, the energy, according to the New York Times, the energy industry has become one of the most active targets for cyber attackers since 2003.
Yeah.
Or 2013, I'm sorry.
Yep.
But it's pretty much the whole infrastructure that's pretty much, it's getting nailed, right?
Well, you know, I was at the Secure 360 conference in May, in the beginning of May here, and I was actually working as a volunteer and a moderator at some of the presentations, and it was very eye-opening. And I sat in on one where they were talking specifically about hacking infrastructure and what have you. And the type of systems that we're talking about are, you know, the automation and control systems, or what's called SCADA systems, and it stands for supervisory control and data acquisition. And in most cases, like electric utilities and water utilities and, you know, fuel distribution utilities are using systems that are not internet connected. So they're not necessarily directly accessible through the internet. But here's the problem. You know, all of these companies have employees who have, you know, email accounts and are on parts of the corporate network that are internet connected. Everybody's got internet at work. So you've got these two systems, and theoretically they're, you know, there's a gap. They're what they call an air gap, but basically that they're not supposed to be interconnected. But there's so many places where sometimes there's a little bit of bleed through, or where they touch, or where a guy is, you know, working on his computer in his office, and he's also like logging into the monitoring system for somewhere else. And if a cyber attacker can get control of that particular system, here he's got a bridge, you know, from the outside world, from the internet side into the network control of operations. But there's other clever techniques that are being used. Things like this. One of the ways to that has actually been used successfully to introduce malware into these types of systems is simply leaving flash drives in employee parking areas. Just leave a flash drive on the ground. You know, you could have like something like pay raises, you know, a little label on it or something that makes it look, or something like top secret or
something interesting.
So somebody picks up a flash drive. Who wouldn't pick up a flash drive if they found it on the ground? You know, these things are cool and can't, you know, I got another one now. And when they go plug it into a USB port, you know, software is installed quietly, you know, surreptitiously or automatically, but quietly. And then, you know, phones, the software is designed basically to call out to the guys who are running this particular exploit. And, typically it'll provide like a Trojan horse type backdoor into the computer. And then they start, you know, monkeying around from there. That is actually how the United States and Israel got, the Stuxnet virus into the Iranian, nuclear program.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. It was all flash drives and other things that work. You know, if you're brazen enough to put on a contractor shirt and, you know, walk in the front door and just ask for access to the server closet or whatever, you can go in with a piece of hardware, plug it into the network, and that hardware will, you know, basically be like a little server of your own on the network that you can use to extend and exploit, you know, the rest of the network. There's little computers now that are about the size of a flash drive. But if you put your index and middle finger together, it's about that size. It contains an entire computer and has a HDMI port. You can buy these for like $150 right on Amazon.com. And plug it in and, you know, turn like any television into a computer. And they have like Wi-Fi and everything else. And there are other little, there's a device, kind of a hobby device called the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
Pi, like the, you know, the number 3.14, not pi like that you would eat. But Raspberry Pi is about, it's a, you know, a circuit board about the size of a playing card, and it has the ability to be configured any number of different ways, but you can set up a Raspberry Pi device and, again, plug it into a network and have all kinds of fun stuff going on there, you know.
There's just so many different ways that they've taken over, or they can take over.
Yeah.
But you know how you see in movies like Live Free and Die Hard, or like the the Italian Job, where they actually take over the traffic lights in a city?
Yeah.
Is that realistic? I mean, is that something that, you know, they show the, you know, the hacker doing it in about 5 minutes, but what is the the realistic deal on that?
Yeah, that it turns out there was a presentation at I think it was the last like Black Hat conference or whatever, but in any event, a guy named Cesar Cerruda, who's a security researcher, actually did that. He hacked into the city traffic light system just to see if it could be done.
Yeah.
And it could. And he was able to basically, you know, change the traffic lights on demand and, you know.
Basically, so, if you know what you're doing, you can pretty much get in anywhere. That's why it gets back to my old point. Any one of us, if somebody really wants to get at me or you or any one of us, they can do it.
Yeah, and one of the things that that we're really seeing is that a lot of these exploits have moved from being, you know, random or, you know, okay, so I'm doing a phishing exploit, so I'll go get my little spamming kit from Spammers R Us in the dark web there and send out, you know, 10 or 20 or 100 million emails with a clickable link and just see who is foolish enough to click, and then I'll do whatever I can with. So this is sort of like a mass, you know, a broadcast type opportunistic type of an attack. We don't know what we're going to end up with, but it could be interesting. What's happening now is that the better, you know, higher caliber criminals out there are doing very focused and targeted attacks where they'll spend, you know, weeks or maybe months researching a target, learning everything they can about the people who, you know, who are in charge, their personal life. They'll try to get into their, you know, personal email account or maybe their Facebook account or other types of accounts and just lurk and learn. And, you know, you can learn a lot about a person if you're reading their email.
And it gets scary if you have a patented product that you're working on, or you have some pretty secretive stuff in your industry, and you have a competitor that has pretty deep pockets, you can really be at.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, it's stuff like this, you know, I mean, so you're reading the email of a CEO somewhere, you may learn about something coming down the pipeline that basically allows you to make a huge score in the stock market. You know, it's a straight up insider trading kind of a thing, but almost impossible to prove. You know, you just look like the lucky guy, you know, that had the right play. And if the CEO made the same investments, well, you get, like, you know, in trouble with the law and might serve a little time or certainly refund all the money plus penalties. And so that, they're, you know, the internet is being used as a lever into what are really very traditional types of crimes, extortion,
whatever crime they can commit.
Yeah,
and they need, know, the information.
Cyber training, you know, industrial espionage. Identity theft is getting to be a really big thing. I mean, a lot of these, you know, when they're hacking a server at a medical insurer, they're not going after credit card numbers. In this case, what they're going for is all the other good information that's in there, including things like, you know, social security numbers, a lot of personal information. There's much more personal information in medical records than typically would be in, like, you know, the records that you might have at your account with Target or Sam's Club or whatever. And And so they're going after these records and then selling them to people who are creating identities. And so there's this new type of identity theft where it's called synthetic identity theft, where they basically create a new identity that's similar to yours. And so they might do it, basically apply for a loan or a credit card using your name, but misspelling it by changing a letter and using a social security number that has is one number off. And because the credit reporting companies will report a near miss, because there's a lot of typographical errors that happen in the world, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, credit agencies will go, yeah, we don't got that one, but we got these ones here. They're close. And so credit is being awarded on the basis of, you know, an assumption that it's really you when it's just a made up identity. And so this type of, you know, identity theft, you know, the programs where you pay $100 a year or whatever to, you know, like LifeLock and what have you.
Yeah.
Well, LifeLock's only protecting you against your actual identity, not any kind of synthetic identity that's created, you know, that looks like you, and you wouldn't even know what's happening.
So it's a way around all those security applications to protect your identity.
Yep. It's, you know, we come up with one way to block them, and they basically tunnel under it and go a different way, and, you know.
Well, it brings me to the fiasco with the IRS that's all over the news right now.
Oh, yeah, that's hilarious.
How did they access over 100,000 tax returns? What is the deal with that?
Well, and interestingly enough, this was not a bulk, you know, this was not a bulk exfiltration like the medical records that went missing at that one insurer whose name I can't remember now. These records were acquired one at a time. And, you know, basically if you get somebody's name, address, and social security number, you've got enough to go and start requesting records from a database like this IRS database. And this is a part of the IRS website that basically supplied last year's or previous year's tax reports, you know, so you filed your taxes in 2011 and for some reason you needed that one, you can get it back from the IRS. They'll send you a copy. So what these guys were doing is they were getting in and either through, you know, requesting password resets or whatever, they were getting in to this database, and then they would turn around and file tax returns for like last year, for 2014. And if they filed before you got around to it, the refund would go to them.
Oh yeah. So this is their way of stealing refunds.
Yeah. And it's all about refund theft. And some states have seen like a tenfold increase in that. And, you know, going after the IRS is pretty gutsy. But a lot of activity is happening in state tax refunds. Fraud is
it's really bad right now. Well, according to the Center for Strategic International Studies, criminal activity online is estimated to cost the United States about $100 billion annually. But, and I think you know this number as well, the FBI also recently stated that they think it's as upwards to $994 billion when you start taking into account like the full picture.
Mm-hmm.
And what would be the full picture, would you say? I mean, this is a huge expense.
Yeah, you're talking, you know, about, you know, pretty close to a $1 trillion in losses every year. And it, you know, represents about 7% of business revenues now. So, you know, it in essence, cybercrime has become a 7% tax on the economy.
And, yeah, that's how you look at it.
Well, you know, I mean, it's, you know, one way to look at it.
And it's a combination of losses that they steal from you, the people you have to hire to do the security work, the downtime when they take down your system, all that added together.
Well, and, you know, not to pick on the target were people at Target, but they are the poster child, unfortunately, for this whole thing. And, you know, I mean,
they were the first big one that came, that hit the media.
Yeah. And the, you know, there was the immediate loss of the credit card information. They lost a certain amount of business during the Christmas season because people said, I'm not going to Target to shop and, you know, lose my card. And then there was the added expense of hiring the, you know, very high paid security firms that came in to do the forensics and, you know, clean up the mess. And then there was the cost of finding a new CEO, and because we fired that guy, and now they've just finally settled the two class action suits with, there were there were a whole bunch of lawsuits that were rolled into two classes.
What a mess.
And one group was basically individuals who were suing because they'd suffered some type of personal financial loss at the hands of this breach. And then there were the banks and credit card companies who suffered losses due to the fraudulent purchases that were made on the credit card numbers that were taken from the breach. And the individual ones settled. The ones with the credit card companies looked like it was settled, but I forget, I think it was MasterCard said, or one of the card companies
backed accepted
settlement. And so that they're still like not enough money. And, but then, you know, the first one was like $40 million and the next one is going to be probably around, you know, 100. So that's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of Kleenex that they got to sell in order to, you know, make that money back. And then, of course, they have become the permanent poster child for, you know, for this type of point of sale exploit. There were literally hundreds of companies that fell victim to this exact same scam, and haven't heard of any new ones lately. So we must have finally plugged that hole. But
They're going after easier targets, right?
Because yeah,
Target probably isn't all that easy of a target anymore all their you know, high profile stuff, but there's so many other companies that are. And they're not getting the publicity that Target got because it's kind of, it's just okay, just another one that's getting
just
hacked.
Just another one, yeah. Yeah. You know, it was, and what was kind of interesting is after the Target breach was announced, then Neiman Marcus announced, but the Neiman Marcus thing actually preceded Target by 18 months.
Oh, wow. So Target just got hosed.
Yeah. No, Neiman Marcus was asleep at the switch, and they were leaking credit cards
for
over a year and a half. And they only found the problem out after reading about the Target thing. And they said, geez, you know, maybe we should check.
Wow. So yeah. Are they suffering lawsuits and everything else?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and then, you know, we had them, you know, Jimmy John's, Dairy Queen, Home Depot. I mean, you know, holy cow, the list was endless there for a while. And we've either gotten bored with that story or and this is probably more to the point, is that they've plugged that leak. But what was really interesting is after the Target breach, the exploits continued using the exact same software. So it wasn't like they kept improving their stuff. It's that their stuff was already so good that it was hard to detect in the first place.
And so many companies aren't, you know, safe from that, and so they just use it at the next company. Well, getting back to the Center for Strategic and International Studies, they have this document that came out that accused China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran as potential sources of threats to the U.S. cybersecurity.
Right.
China's not too happy about this document, needless to say, and they're pretty angry about it. But it's probably pretty true, right? I mean, a lot of the stuff does come out of those countries.
Yeah. Yeah, and another country to put on the list is North Korea. North Korea has actually got a pretty effective cyber war group in their military services, but as well. And, you know, North Korea, let's face it, they're just like a really angry little country.
Well, they're awful. They're awful when you read some of the stuff.
And what they're trying to do is really, really harmful. A Chinese, we see there. I mean, when you're looking at traffic, you know, internet traffic and the kind of attacks that are going on, their fingerprints are everywhere. And the Chinese are very interesting in that they're not very choosy about what they're going after. They want everything. And what they really are engaged in is kind of like the world's biggest research project, if we wanted to be kind about it, because they're just going in and stealing information primarily with a goal in mind of, manufacturing your stuff in their factories and selling it cheaper in Africa and Asia and Europe and stuff like that.
They want intellectual property so they can remake the products and sell it everywhere.
Yeah, they're not looking to set up a denial of service attack or take over, U.S. military drones flying mission over Iraq. They're not looking to take down the electric utility network, although they may be interested in setting that up. But they just want to basically have everything that we know. And let's get serious. The Japanese did it back, to us back in the 70s. And, we didn't have the internet. And what the Japanese did is they bought one, took it apart, blueprinted it, and figured out how to make it.
They reverse engineered it.
Yeah, it's right. Reverse engineering. And the Chinese are just going, well, we don't have to do that. We can just go get the plans. And so that's
it's easier now.
Yeah. And so that's, and the Chinese are very, very sensitive about being wrapped up with these other groups. And maybe they have a right to be. The Russian cybercrime stuff that's going on is definitely criminal groups. A lot of them are run by ex-KGB, or they have, people on their board who are actively in the government. Most of these Russian criminal groups have government
So would you almost characterize China as like a white collar crime versus
the rest
of them are more like, war crimes. Yeah.
Well, and Iran is going after us for basically, screwing with their nuclear program and for having run, 30 years of sanctions, economic sanctions against them.
It's a Middle East issue and them not liking the power the United States has in that area and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's another Islamic versus Christian, great Satan, blah, blah. It's more political. So you've really got basically your three types of cyber attacks. You've got your white collar, intellectual property type attacks. You've got your straight up criminal attacks. And then you've got your politically motivated attacks. And then there's the little fringe groups of, groups like Anonymous and Lulzsec and the hacktivist groups who are hacking for the greater good of humanity,
Yeah. Maybe.
Like there was an attack, there was an attack on the companies who whaling companies in Japan. So they go and they go after their networks in order to make it harder for them to kill whales,
Because, they use it for peace.
Yeah,
Or whatever they think is the cause.
Yeah, and the thing that we're, that we're really kind of learning as we're going along, the internet started out as sort of a club. You had to be admitted to the club in order to play on the internet. And when it got to be a open to the world commercial type of a thing, it still had the club format. And, in a club, we don't need a lot of security. So you're in a Tony club. Nobody puts locks on their lockers in a country club because we all paid a boatload of money to join. And, those lockless lockers are no good when you're at a public gym like the YMCA or Lifetime or whatever. And even if you have a lock, it may not help you. So,
especially if they have the holes in the locker where they can see your stuff inside.
Yeah. Well, and so we're, the people who are in charge of engineering the internet are going back to the open protocols that we used, you know, in the early times, and are creating, shall we say, security baked in type protocols to replace them. And a lot more encryption is going on, and it's not only encrypted in place, you know, so it's encrypted on the hard drive, but it's also encrypted in transit. So when it's going across the network, it's encrypted, and it makes it much harder. Because as I said, encryption cannot be broken easily, and if at all, you know, usually if you're going to break an encrypted stream, you really need to steal the keys, you know, the encryption keys, because you're not going to decrypt this stream of traffic. It's just not going to happen in a time frame that matters. And so anyway, there's, you know, I guess what I'm saying is that we're changing the way we look at this whole thing, and it's
well, there has to be, right? We have to rethink the whole problem.
Because, it, you know, the losses, they're increasing, you know, and you'll get to a point where the losses are so high that, you know, it companies start to die.
And they probably are, some of them. It's like putting Band-Aids on wounds, and you just keep getting, keeps bleeding out.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, you know, one cut, not so bad, two cuts, not so bad. Well, you know, it's you get 1,000 cuts, all of a sudden you're, you know, leaking serious blood there, so.
Well, there's a talent crisis in the cyber world, right? I mean, with all this stuff going on, it's really hard to find people that are skilled enough to deal with this.
Yeah, if you got kids, that's what they want to do, is get a degree in cybersecurity, you know, go to computer school and focus on the security side, because it right now there's a negative 7% unemployment rate in cybersecurity positions, which basically is a way of saying there's 7% more jobs than there are qualified individuals to fill them.
And so that basically that means that they have people in jobs that aren't qualified.
Yeah.
That's what that means. But
a lot of people are going back to school, you know, computer people, or people who used to be computer people, are going back to school and picking up the security piece that they need in order to step into these roles. And, you know, it's like what I did for that matter.
Well, they're pretty good. Like your business is booming.
Yeah.
Because you know what you're doing. And so it's just people, you're in high demand. But like ISIS and these different groups are also recruiting all the time, aren't they?
Well, yeah. And you know, we have, you know, the Islamic State of, what is it, Iraq and Syria or whatever that stands for. And as opposed to just blowing things up and shooting people, they're actually grabbing land and trying to create a nation state. And they have, you know, they have guys who are running the oil refineries so that they can make money and fund themselves. But they've also got an active cyber, you know, a bunch of cyber warriors who are all basically, you know, making money through the criminal exploits on the web, or, you know, just
figuring out the U.S. plans and things.
Yeah. I
mean, well, and, you know, you have countries like India who have so many highly skilled computer programmers and things that there's really a good base of workers to tap into if you pay them well.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, it's kind of interesting when you look at India. India's got some really great tech schools. You know, more engineers and scientists are graduated from Indian universities than anywhere else on the planet. And, you know, as a percentage of their population, and maybe quite frankly, numerically too, because India is going to replace China as the most populous planet on the earth within the next decade or so. But in any event, there's a lot of really talented skills out there. And of course, I run across it in, run across them providing, you know, we all know about Indian tech support. You know,
sure, yeah.
Your call for tech support for anything, you end up talking to some guy in India. And my experience in working with these people is that they're very good. But it seems to me that the companies that they're working for reward them for, shall we say, the creative extraction of extra cash. And I sometimes wonder, you know, companies like HP and Dell or whoever else is, hiring Indian companies for tech support, if they really understand some of the really questionable activities that are going on where they're selling additional products and services and charging $300 for an annual support plan. And then when you call in for support on your annual support plan, oh, that's not covered under your plan. You got to pay us more money. I just don't know if, you know, if they're
on top of it and they're really paying attention to what's going on.
I mean, without sounding, you know, like I'm racially insensitive, which I guess, you know, who knows, maybe I am. But you know, the values structure in Asia is a little bit more that connivory and chicanery is an acceptable business practice.
Well, they have a different culture on that. Yeah. You know, I got to say, just so that we qualify this, some of the best people I've ever worked with have come from China and India, and you know, they pretty much are equal to 50 people. I always say that a good technology person can be equal to just a whole group. Right. And I've seen some of those people, and some of them I've worked with, some of the best ones have come out of India. However, they do have like Mexico does too, bribery is part of their culture.
A more flexible ethical structure.
Yeah, and
it's normal for them. And we have our rules here in the United States, and we just break them flagrantly all the time, you know.
And we're pretty corrupt when it comes to politics and some government stuff we do. And we can get into some of that.
But the
everyday workings is a little more straightforward.
Yeah. I'm not exactly sure if that's part of the agreement that the U.S. tech companies think that they're signing up for, if they check. And if it is acceptable, well, then I'm really kind of peeved.
Well, yeah, because that's not.
I'm calling HP for tech support, and now they're trying to, like, you know, make it more expensive for me. That's not support.
Well, this gets into what happened in China, this Rent-A-Hitman mobile app that talked about in the blog. And that would never happen. Well, I can't say never happen in the United States because we're pretty much moving in a different direction. But the fact that this actually worked in China and it got 50,000 downloads, you want to explain that?
Yeah, it was this was kind of Rent-A-Thug. Basically, you could hire a big guy to go pound somebody using a mobile app, sort of like Uber. You know, only it's like hire a bully. So you're having a dispute with somebody and, you know, you're small and wimpy. And so you could, I'm using this mobile phone app, you could hire a guy. And these were like ex-military guys or maybe a gym teacher or somebody who was, you know, big and muscular and, you know, basically would go and shove somebody around and get them to back off your case or whatever. It wasn't like actually like hiring the death squad or anything. It was a little bit more just like thuggery. And the app was pulled fairly quickly by the Chinese mobile phone operator. But the fact that the app survived in the app store as long as it did and was able to be downloaded 50,000 times, well, you know, that's kind of saying something.
But then it's funny, but it's not.
But then you kind of look at it, and here we've got, I saw one, there's some sort of mobile app called Fiverr, and I just saw it like yesterday, the day before. And basically, it's kind of like hire a handyman, you know, it's like anything for $5. Remember Larry, Daryl, and Daryl from that TV show, Anything for a Buck?
Yeah.
Well, this is Fiverr, you know, time's gone by, it's five now. And, but I'm kind of thinking, well, not all those jobs are going to be $5 jobs, but what's going to keep some creative person from, you know, basically being like your personal negotiator. You know, we can couch this as like right, escort services. We all know what an escort is. And so I'm going to hire a negotiator, and this guy's going to go and negotiate for me, right? And
you just don't know what their methods of negotiation will be. Yeah. Well, yeah. What's going on with the NSA lately?
Well, now the Section 217 or whatever of the Patriot Act, which is probably the worst named bit of legislation ever, and it didn't take me, 15 years to figure it out. I was opposed to the Patriot Act when it was proposed. And it's amazing, you can take a really bad idea that it totally interferes with everybody's individual liberties and constitutional rights, and then wrap it in a word like patriot, and make it seem,
and they can sell it to the public.
Yeah,
it's something good.
Basically, wrapping fur around a turd and calling it a mink coat, but anyway. The section that allowed for the wholesale collection of communication data was not renewed. And so theoretically, the NSA now has to back off this, scooping up everything and saving it for a rainy day sort of a thing. Based on everything I'm reading about the NSA and what was going on even before 2001. The NSA happened in 2001. Well, NSA was created in 1958 or something like that. And they've always been, they're kind of a little bit like the CIA. They've always been, the NSA was about signals intelligence, which is basically phone and other stuff that flows over a wire. Well, when the internet came along, that became part of it too. And, but the NSA and the CIA have both been flagrantly violating, the laws of the United States since day one. And, maybe they have to do that to do their job. And maybe, the people who write the laws aren't always the brightest guys in the world either. And, I always like to say that, I won't say it.
You were going to say something that would be fun.
Well, all right. But, if you scratch a legislature, you go down to the state house, you go to Congress, they're all attorneys, right? Well, attorneys who are really good at litigating, they never run for public office. They're making too much money.
Oh, exactly. Yes.
Right. So the people who end up in the government are attorneys who weren't that great as attorneys. And now they're writing the laws, and it's kind of like you just don't have your A team in there. But in any event, this book I just finished reading by Bruce Schneier, Data and Goliath, goes very deeply into the whole NSA thing. But at the end of the book, he's talking about, what can we do? And he comes to the conclusion, we can't stop them from surveilling, because otherwise we'd just basically be, vulnerable to attacks from every little tin pot dictator in the world. And, but he's very definitely, into, you can't scoop up all the data and save it and say, I might need this in case. Because your private little life and my private little life, we're not doing anything, but,
to have some kind of probable cause.
He made a point that I've made for years. Not that I invented it, but I'm sure there are other people who feel the same way, is that if the government knows absolutely everything there is to know about you, on the day they decide you're a pain in their backside, they can find enough to get you on some law you either didn't know you were breaking, or that everybody breaks, like jaywalking or speeding, or
there's something that we all do that's bad, and we just don't even know it. We're breaking laws because there's so many of them.
Yeah, nobody's perfect, and there's so many laws out there that you don't even know about that, you know, it happens. And the issue isn't that I don't have anything to hide. It's that you shouldn't be forced to share your whole life with the government. None of their dang business.
That's true. But with this, all this cybersecurity problem becoming a complete nightmare, it becomes that double-edged sword where we need protection, but yet we don't need that.
Well, and that's, you know, this is another part of the stuff that he brought up, is that the NSA and the Homeland Security and some of the other, you know, alphabet soup agencies out there have been actively working to weaken some of the security that we have, like creating master keys for decrypting stuff, or creating backdoors in hardware or software applications to allow them to eavesdrop more easily. Well, if there's a backdoor for the NSA, there's a backdoor for Sergey.
Exactly.
You know, it's just
exactly. It's the same thing.
Of you know, getting that information, and those guys get hacked the same way, you know, we do, or you get, you know, disgruntled employees who leave, or guys like Edward Snowden who leave and spill the beans in a more of a, this needs to be known because it has to stop sort of a way. But, and
they're doing, let's be honest though, they're doing more than just, the problem is not just surveying us for our safety when we have so many cyber attack issues. The
right.
problem is some of the stuff that they're doing that's beyond that. And that's where you start to question.
Well, you know, and so theoretically, the NSA is supposed to be doing signals intelligence against non-U.S. nationals. Okay, so if you're a U.S. citizen, you should never run across the NSA. But the Internet goes everywhere. And even if they're sitting in, you know, France, siphoning a T1 line or T1, yeah, optical line, your traffic could accidentally flow out there and be scooped up anyway. And because of the way the Internet works and the way routing works across the Internet, you know, if you're sending an email to your cousin in Denver, it may end up going through Tokyo. You know, it just could happen. But anyway, the problem is that the NSA is scooping up information about illegal activity that's happening here in the United States, then sharing it with like the FBI. And that's really not part of their mandate, but the NSA isn't just looking at cyber attackers anymore. They're like drug dealers and money launderers and, you know, gun runners and whatever. If they happen to scoop something up that looks interesting, they just pass it on to the appropriate law enforcement agency, and you know, there you go.
And it's not bad if you knew that they were good people themselves. You know what I mean? If we could have some kind of halo effect, and we could put them in a bubble, and we knew they were all good people. The problem is that bad people can get in mixed up with that lot too, and next thing you know, this bad person has all your information.
Well, they have all these acronyms, and you mentioned one before we started, you know, PRISM, and there's like more program names at the NSA than you can imagine. But there's one that was really kind of funny. It's called LoveInt, LoveInt. LoveInt is the term that they use for when an NSA employee spies on a spouse or a girlfriend or a boyfriend.
Oh, they actually have the term for it.
The love interest, you know. So this is when you're doing personal, you know, you're doing personal espionage. And this is the problem, is that I don't care what kind of a Boy Scout you are, when you're given almost unlimited power to surveil whatever you feel like.
Exactly.
You know, curiosity or envy or jealousy or whatever, and all of a sudden you're towing the line today, and tomorrow you're well across it, and you know.
That's the problem, and that's what our Constitution tried to protect us from, because they know that you need to have a limited government, because that is the source of the issue.
Yeah, and the problem, you know, the problem at the NSA is the same problem that we have in corporations all over America, is that the employees are just cannot be, the employees are not that reliable. Yeah, we're human. We make mistakes and we do stupid things. That's what makes us, you know.
What makes us human. We're stupid.
So we just got a different kind of highly trained stupid person working over there, and, you know, occasionally. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure as shooting that, they just love to tell us about all the stuff they've stopped and they can't, which is really kind of a shame, but, you know.
Yeah, but exactly. That's part of it. But
you know, if they were able to, like, put, you know, put their wins up on the scoreboard, you know, we'd all probably be going more. But we're to a point now where, you know, we're like.
Well, but that's where there needs to be go ahead.
Yeah, we're like 12 years into the Patriot Act. We're fighting an endless war in the Middle East that we know is never going to be over because it never hasn't been going on. I mean, you know. Scratchy little bit of dirt over there has been a war zone since the Bible times, for crying out loud. And it's like, you know, why should we fix it up?
Well, we have bad guys too, doing things with the wrong agendas, and we got a mess going on here too. It's just whether our mess is a little bit better than other people's messes. I mean, I don't know. Some of the stuff I've looked at is, you know, pretty scary, but this is a hard problem.
Yeah. Well, we've done, you know, I mean, historically, just from the, you know, like 1900. I mean, we've done a lot of things. And when I say we, not just the United States, but Europe and what have you, we've done a lot of bad things in the Middle East where we promised them independence and their own countries. And then we divided it up into a bunch of colonies and we split the.
Yeah, we say one thing and do another thing.
Yeah. Then, I mean, we split the countries up because it made sense for you know, France and England to divide things up that way without any regard to, you know, tribal realities on the ground. And so you end up with Sunnis and Shiites and Turks and, you know, all these people living in the same country when they wouldn't have done that if they divided it up themselves. So we've made our own mess over there.
We really have, and that's the issue. Well, you know, I could sit and talk to you all day.
Yeah.
This is fun. But how can people, of course, how can people get hold of you? Because you have a wealth of knowledge. You do talks. Yep. You do talks, right, for people. You teach courses. You also go in and help people come up with their security strategy and things. So how can people get hold of you if they want to?
Well, best way is probably off the website, wiseguyscybersecurity.com. And the spelling's a little unique. It's WYZ, or Whiskey Yankee Zulu, if you're into that military, you know, talk, wiseguyscybersecurity.com. My weblog is on there. You can get directly to the weblog by, going to bobwiseguy.com. Points directly to the blog page. I encourage people to sign up there. We'll deliver the articles by email to your inbox so you don't have to track me down. If you're interested in following along, we're publishing new articles 2 to 3 times a week. And then I have a funny little something I do on, Sundays, which, you know, is just sort of hopefully a bonus.
But it really keeps people up to date on what's going on in the cyber security world.
Otherwise, I am doing I'm locally here in the Twin Cities. I'm doing lunch and learns for Chamber of Commerce. I just did one for SCORE last month. I'll be doing something for the Vadnais Heights Economic Development Commission next month on the 7th. And there'll be more coming. And then, of course, I am available to, you know, one of the things that if you're a business owner and you really want to get a handle on cybersecurity, one of the fundamentals, the cheapest thing you can do that'll give you the most bang for your buck is to train your employees on how to recognize and exploit when it comes into their inbox, because that's where it's going to happen. And we do a 2 to 3 hour seminar for employers. We'll put it on in your space or in any space that you want to go in. And we get very specific about what to look, you know, what to look for, how to know, how to avoid it and stuff like that. So.
Yeah. And that's something everybody needs to start, should be paying attention to. Otherwise they're going to part of that stat.
Yeah. You can spend tens of thousands of dollars on all the technology that you want to secure your network. And one employee clicking on a link in a tricky email is all it takes to open the door to your network. So.
Yeah. So it's a first and foremost is to get them educated. Well, thank you, Bob. Thank you. And I will have your information on the website and, I'll also have it on, you know, my radio page and at my website and we'll go from there.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we're going to have you back.
Yeah. I'll look forward to it. Thanks again.
Okay. Have a great day.
You too. Bye now.
Like always, if you want to find Bob Weiss's contact information or information on any other guests I've had on the program, you can find that on my website at www.sarahwestall.com, or you can find it on my radio page at webtalkradio.net. And also look for us on iTunes under Business Game Changers or my name, Sarah Westall. For now, have a wonderful day.